From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. When eviction rates are high, people often rush to blame landlords, and that's not really fair.
When you look across the total evictions that happen within Savannah, the Public Housing Authority ranks as the third highest utilizer of the court systems for dispossessory actions.
Mark Rourke is a professor at Savannah Law School. We'll talk about the high rate of evictions in Savannah and Atlanta this hour. First, though, Friday we talked about, well, how we talk here in the South.
The word y'all, a conjunction of you all, predominantly used in the South.
It's y'all. It's just a Southern thing, I guess.
Oh, I text y'all. And then if it's like y'all's place, it's like Y apostrophe A-L-L apostrophe S.
I'm from New York, and I pretty much adapted that about a couple years ago since my fiance says it and everybody in the world says it.
I lived in New York for a while, and I said it there, too, so I'm good with it. I'm proud.
That's what people at a high school football game in Woodstock, Georgia, told us. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is Leslie Morris from Macon. There are a lot of white Southern accents and a lot of black Southern accents, and you cannot lump them all in one. I grew up in Atlanta when it was still a small Southern city, and I've never said y'all. I say you all, but never y'all. There are just lots and lots of different ways to talk Southern.
Hello, my name is Pax Bobrow. I live in Augusta, Georgia, and I am from Staten Island, New York, and I never, ever sounded like the people I grew up with, who all sounded like this, and I can talk like them if I want to, but I never did. So when I was a child, they thought I was from England.
Yes, I'm a native Georgian. My family's been here since the 1700s. To me, I don't have an accent.
This is Michael from Smyrna. You know, I have family that comes from the South. The earlier generations kind of spoke in those stereotypical kind of cliche manners, or at least cliche according to the movies. But as we kind of modernized and we got more military communities and bigger cities, it really got away from that.
We always love to know what you think and how you talk. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OSD Talk. Or post to Facebook. Just remember, we might feature your comments on the show. For years, Atlanta has worked to turn around its failing public schools. Charter schools have begun to appear in the past few years as an alternative to many of the troubled facilities. In David Osborne's new book, Reinventing America's Schools, he suggests charter school-like guidelines that all schools should follow, including Atlanta's, and he joins me now in the studio. Hi, David.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Maureen Downey, education reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It's good to have you back, Maureen.
Good morning.
So, David, let's start with, the parts of the charter school that you think should be emulated or repeated throughout the public school system. Which part?
Well, there are several. The first is autonomy. Let the people who run the school actually run the school. People don't realize that in a traditional urban district, principals often can't select their teachers. They can't fire their teachers because of tenure. They have no control over the pay scale, and they can't fiddle with the educational model very much. So they don't have the ability to change the school and turn it around. People running charters do. So that autonomy is first. And then
can we just test that autonomy here really quickly? Mm-hmm. First, because autonomy, how far do you want that to go? Because there has to be oversight. And we have seen in some charter schools places in which insufficient oversight has gone badly wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There has to be oversight. There are still some rules. There are things that charters are not allowed to do, such as discriminate, such as choose, handpick their kids. But in places where there isn't oversight and they don't have accountability, that is, the overseer doesn't close the ones that are failing, then charter schools are not much better than the traditional schools. In places that do that, where they have active oversight and the really weak schools get replaced by better operators, that's where you see really high performance in the charter sector.
Maureen, what's your response? Do Atlanta public schools not have this kind of local control that David's talking about?
You know, you know, even some of the charter schools in Georgia across APS and the entire state don't have some of the freedom that David's talking about because they're district chartered. So I think the schools that have the most freedom, the kind that David means, are the schools that are what I would call startup charters. So they started from scratch. They had been separate from the district all along. You know, I think my concern about David's theory is that everything, or David's recommendation is that if everything worked as it was supposed to, which is what would make the charter plan work, everyone has to be doing their job well and the right people have to be in their jobs. If we can make that happen, we can make that happen under the current setting as well. Even traditional public schools, as we know them now, could be successful if everyone was doing their job at the high level that he recommends in his book.
I actually disagree with that, with all due respect. I think our problem is not so much the people in traditional public school districts. I think most, 99.9% of them are dedicated, hardworking, trying to help the kids. The problem is they're trapped in a system that was designed over a century ago. We're using an organizational model called bureaucracy. It's centralized, it's hierarchical, it's rule-driven, and it just, in any sector of American society today, it doesn't perform very well anymore.
I want to play a comment from David Mitchell. He is with the group Better Outcomes for Our Kids. And one of the complaints that he has about charter schools is that they can cause racial divides. Take a listen.
We believe in a lot of this charter movement in Atlanta, particularly in communities that don't have the white flight issue. It's black people, and then there's more black people. Don't even understand that there are options out there for them. And so when these schools like KIPP or Kadesi or others that have come into the community, what has happened is they have felt like this movement has happened to them and not with them.
So, David, we're going to get down your list of recommendations. But what's your response to this? Because we have seen this occur in communities in which charter schools are seen as an sort of an alternative to that segregates kids as opposed to private schools.
Yeah, and I think that's really unfortunate. That is an issue in the South that isn't the case in most of the rest of the country. We should be using charter schools and choice to integrate the schools, not to segregate the schools. And it's the responsibility of the charter authorizers, if that's the state or if it's a district, to try to prevent that and promote integration.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with, we're talking about charter schools and how what we might learn from them and then integrate into the public schools. David Osborne is the author of Reinventing America's Schools, and Maureen Downey is the education reporter and writes the Get Schooled blog on the AJC. All right, so we talked about greater autonomy. What other things do you think charter schools have that public schools should have?
The key, well, charters are public schools. It's a question of whether we're talking about 20th century public schools or 21st.
Okay.
The second thing is accountability. We let, too often in traditional districts, we let failing schools, high schools where 50% of the kids are dropping out, we let them go on year after year after year. In the charter sector, if it's done according to how charters are supposed to be run, you get typically 5 years. That's your charter as a performance contract for 5 years. And if the kids are falling behind grade level too far, your charter is not renewed and you close. And that changes everything. You know, all of us...
If it happens, it changes everything.
If it happens, absolutely. And in the places where it doesn't happen, we don't get high performance.
Right.
So I totally agree with that. It's critical. And it's beginning in the district sector, too. I mean, the districts are changing. But... you know, there's a reason that the cities I write about, New Orleans, Washington, D.C., Denver, are the fastest improving cities in the country. And the reason is they give their schools autonomy, and then if they're not succeeding, they replace them with a much stronger operator.
The difficulty being that the vast majority of charter schools, 37% of them do worse than their public schools, and something like, I think, almost half of them do pretty much exactly the same.
That's data from 2009, which was on a study that ended in 2007 or 2008. The same organization, which is at Stanford University, has done updated studies. In 2015, they did a study of 42 urban areas, and it said that when a kid is in their fourth year in a charter, they're learning they're getting an extra half a year of learning every year compared to the same kid demographically with the same past test scores in a district school.
Maureen, do the traditional public schools not have the accountability that charter schools do?
Well, you know, again, there's practice, and then there is what is supposed to happen. You know, I would say that speaking in Georgia now, I think we have about the same accountability here for our traditional schools and our charter schools. We've been very careful, and our charters have not been approved at the rate of some of the states, Ohio, for example, or Michigan. So I think we have charter schools that are doing okay, and we're not closing a lot of them. When charters come up for renewal, it happens everywhere, not just in Georgia. One of the problems I have is that parents like their schools. Parents like schools that even aren't doing so well. And we've had pressure from charter school parents to keep open schools that are not doing so well. And I think that it's the same standard with the public schools. We have public schools that aren't doing so well, but there's no clamor from the parents for the state to come in and take over those schools. In fact, there is resistance of parents.
Yeah, they voted down the plan, Governor Nathan Deal's plan, that would have done that.
So I think that what we have here is a situation where I think that there is a parent factor that has to be weighted, whether talking any kind of public school, and that is what parents perceive their school versus what we label the school as failing, which in Georgia is largely on test scores. And David, in your book, you actually say we should step back from that a little bit. Mm-hmm. If we step back from test scores in Georgia, we would have fewer failing schools across the board, charter and traditional. The thing I want to talk about with David's book is that to me, the charter movement, particularly in New Orleans, Washington, and Denver, it relies on an infusion of very young, hardworking staff. These are folks who, as you point out in your book, take phone calls at 10 o'clock at night. These are folks who will never stop trying, who give far more than the standard hours.
Yeah.
And you know, Dr. Haberman out of University of Milwaukee once described those teachers as missionaries, and I think you use that term in your book as well. Can we build a system, is my question, on where we're asking people to essentially burn themselves out?
Yeah.
And I know that charter school teachers, some of the who are with these really high-achieving charters, they have had to leave because they cannot simply do 15 hours a day. They can do it at 22 and 25, then they get married and suddenly they can't do it. I think we have to look at how can we build good schools that still allow their staff to have their own lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We have about a minute left, David, and I wanted to allow you to respond to that.
Sure. If you go to Denver and D.C. and New Orleans, they're struggling with this and they're evolving. And I think part of the solution is technology. Schools are learning how to use online education for math and a few other things to help the kids acquire the content knowledge, and then using the teachers for the more value-added seminars, projects, deeper learning. And I think that's kind of the future, and it's so interesting to watch these places like New Orleans and Denver evolve over time because they definitely struggle with that. But, you know, we really shouldn't we be looking, these cities have doubled the effectiveness of their schools in less than a decade. Shouldn't we be looking at that for some lessons?
That's David Osborne. He's author of the new book, Reinventing America's Schools. He'll give a talk at the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta today at noon. Also with us, Maureen Downey. She writes the Get Schooled blog for the AJC. Thanks so much to both of you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, I hope you're not afraid of spiders. That's what we're talking about. And why are so many Georgians being evicted from their homes? This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Atlanta has the third highest eviction rate in the country. That's according to a study by the rental service Apartment List. The eviction rate in Atlanta is just below 6%. That's right behind Memphis and Phoenix. With me to discuss this is Kimberly Charles, an attorney with the Atlanta Legal Aid Society. Hi, Kimberly.
Good morning.
And from Chicago, we have Ryan Kuhn, CEO and co-founder of Rentolutions. Am I pronouncing that right, Ryan?
You are. Thank you for having me.
So, Kimberly, what exactly influences an eviction rate? What are sort of the forces behind that statistic?
Well, you have to start with the process. The state law for evictions varies from state to state. It is definitely not something that it's a eviction in real estate law is a state based law, not a federal law. So it is going to vary from state to state. Georgia has very landlord friendly eviction laws, and the eviction process in Georgia is designed to be a summary process that can get a tenant out in as little as 6 or 8 weeks' time.
Whoa, that's very fast.
Yes, yes. Also, in the state of Georgia, the inability to pay your rent is not a legal defense to an eviction.
So let's actually hear. This is a comment from Chris Salviati, who's a researcher with Apartment List and conducted this study. He says eviction is more common and widespread than even he originally thought.
About 3.3% of renters cited that they had been evicted at some point in the past. But if you look at the question when we ask if you've been unable to pay all or part of your rent in the past 3 months, the answer to that was 18% of all respondents answered yes to that question.
So, Ryan, I want to make sure we are clear on those statistics. Less than 4% of people have been evicted in the past year or so, but nearly 1 in 5 have been unable to pay their rent, at least not pay all of it, in the past 3 months. Does that statistic surprise you particularly?
No, unfortunately, it doesn't. I think 1 in 5 people have struggled paying their rent, and a lot of that is caused by the demand for rental properties is going up, and the supply just hasn't kept up. And what that supply-demand imbalance has caused is an increase in rent prices that goes a lot beyond the growth in wages in this country.
So, I mean, to a certain extent, I guess we shouldn't be surprised by the 1 in 5 because nearly 14% of Americans now live below the poverty level. But Kimberly, when we talk about the rise in rental prices, how quickly can a landlord raise your rent? I mean, is there laws that determine whether they can increase your rent or not?
In Georgia, it's dependent upon the lease, the contract between the landlord and the tenant. If you are in a month-to-month lease with a landlord and it's private housing that's not subsidized in any way by a federal or state entity, your rent can go up with as little as 30 days' notice. And if you're in a lease, your rent is set for the term of the lease. So a year-long lease, the tenant can, you know, have a secure idea of what their rent's going to be for that year. But at the end of the lease, the landlord is free to raise the rent.
Ryan, what are the reasons? Kimberly addressed this one about tenants not paying rent or not paying it in full. What are the other sort of common reasons why an eviction occurs?
Yeah, so non-payment of rent does account for about 75% of all evictions. The other causes that can cause eviction are property damage or illegal activity going on at the property.
And what are the solutions to it? Is it as damaging for a landlord to have to evict someone, Ryan, as it is for the tenant to be evicted?
Absolutely. So at Rentolutions, we work with more than 50,000 landlords nationwide. And what we find is that about 40% of these landlords, their rental property is their biggest investment. So the eviction process doesn't just cause stress for the renter. It's really a stressful time for the landlord as well.
And one of the things that complicates this, Kimberly, is many tenants don't actually know what their legal rights are. I want to play this comment from Mark Rourke. He's with the Savannah Law School, and he says, again, some tenants could use some legal representation.
And it comes because these are actions where the tenant is overwhelmingly outmatched by counsel on the other side. Tenants oftentimes will lack the sophistication and even the capacity to understand all of the reasons or all the basis by which they may find themselves running afoul of the housing authority's rules and regulations.
So how complicated is the laws regarding tenants and landlords in Georgia?
It's a gauntlet for a tenant. First of all, you have to know that when you are served with the actual eviction warrant, that you have the right and the duty to go down there and file an answer. When you get to the court, the clerks lawfully cannot give out legal advice. It's unlawful for a clerk to give legal advice. And in most courts, you don't have a sea of tenant attorneys hanging out. If they do answer the eviction on time, they have 7 days to file an answer, 7 calendar days to file an answer.
Not business days, so that includes Saturday and Sunday.
Right. So if they make it to court, then when they get there, there are a sea of attorneys all representing the landlords.
Yeah. And okay, so Ryan, you've expressed that it's probably better for everybody involved to avoid evictions. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely.
So what's missing here, especially in places like Georgia? We have a huge number of evictions in Atlanta itself. There's a huge number in Savannah. And even in the South, there's new news that that in Durham, North Carolina, there's over 10,000 evictions since the middle of last year. So what are we missing in this process?
Yeah, I think as Kimberly noted, the education does play a huge role in avoiding eviction process. So educating both the landlords and the tenants about each of their different responsibilities and duties. I think the other big thing that's missing is communication. I think that as you noted, in the South, there have been a spike in evictions. I think a lot of that is caused, unfortunately, by an influx of these big institutional rental owners who are oftentimes not as willing or as likely to communicate with the tenant as they should be.
And Kimberly, you're nodding your head vigorously. This is a complaint we're hearing all the time, is gentrification, that people want to get the tenants out because they either want to tear it down and build something more lucrative, or they simply want to attract higher paying clients.
Well, and you're dealing with large institutional landlords that use automatic payment systems, and they'll do things like lock the tenant out after day 3 or day 5 if they haven't made their payment.
Which is illegal.
Well, yes, likely. But there's an argument to be made, yes. But they'll lock the tenant out, and then the tenant tries to pay rent, and they get charged a late fee. And then they can't communicate with the landlord on site, or there is no landlord on site. And then they get charged, if it gets to day 15, there's a dispossessory charge of $200, which is way more than the filing fee. So it starts to snowball for the tenant very quickly.
So your best recommendation to a tenant who may be struggling to pay rent?
Try to talk to the landlord early and often about your situation, and give Legal Aid a call. Either Georgia Legal Services or Atlanta Legal Aid, both can provide advice to low-income tenants that qualify for our services.
Ryan, any different advice for you for a tenant that is struggling?
Yeah, I think one of the things, and we touched on this earlier, unfortunately, Georgia has a law where non-payment of rent is grounds for eviction. So regardless of the cleanliness or the ability to live in the property, a tenant is still required to make those monthly rent payments. So if you get in a situation as a renter where you're in a situation you don't feel like you should pay the rent,
yeah,
you still should. That way you can avoid the eviction process altogether.
Okay, that is Ryan Kuhn. He's CEO and co-founder of Rentolutions, and Kimberly Charles is an attorney with the Atlanta Legal Aid Society. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Types of spiders have been found in Georgia, in Athens specifically. Bad news if you are arachnophobe, glad tidings if you're an arachnologist, a person who studies spiders. And that's Bud Freeman. He and his team of spider hunters lead the search for new types of arachnids all across the state. He's also director of the Georgia Museum of Natural History. Hi, Bud.
Hi, Celeste. Good morning.
Congratulations, I guess, are in order. How common is it to find new types of spiders?
there are probably many cryptic species that we don't see, but it's really fortunate to see something large and showy like these two spiders that turned up this year in Clark County.
And I saw pictures of them. Maybe you could describe them for listeners.
Sure. The they're both right now in the genus Nephila, okay, and this is a group of tropical spiders. And the banana spider, and folks in South Georgia and South Carolina will often call them breakbacks. If you're walking through the woods and see this large spider, you stop in your tracks. All right, so that's the banana spider. The other spider, which is brand new, is the Juro spider. And it hails from China, Japan, Korea, reports as far south as India. So it has a wide distribution.
So
I'm sorry,
I was just going to ask about the banana spider because I thought they were only found in like Central and South America, but they're big, right? They cover your whole hand.
They're big. I mean, you know, legs and all, they might cover most of your hand, but they have a large showy web. It's gold. But here's what's really interesting. There was an article published a couple of years ago that was a review of the expansion of the range of the banana spider. And it turns out that the first documented occurrence of the banana spider in the United States was in 1863.
Oh, wow.
And in the port of Charleston. And so Darwin noted in 1845 that spiders often can attach to the riggings of ships. And so I'm thinking that perhaps the banana spider was the first of two of these spiders that were transported by commerce, by shipping. And you're quite right. If you go to Costa Rica, you'll see banana spiders. And that gives somebody pause and say, wait a minute, that's a tropical species. What's it doing up in in temperate climates?
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. Not as hot, and even though it feels like it, and not quite as wet as South America. So, I mean, what is the interest? What are your questions now about these spiders, besides how they got here? What's your next question as you watch them?
What's several of them. Okay, so one question is, how far will the Juro spider establish itself? I mean, obviously, if it can withstand winters in temperate climates like Japan and Korea, it should do well here. And we know it's been in Georgia we're estimating at least 6 years. So we want to learn something about its life history. What are its potential impacts on the rest of the ecosystem, if any? And there may be zero impacts. Okay. And then the second thing is, now we have two related species suddenly in contact with each other. What's going to happen?
You mean, are they going to crossbreed and create a mutant banana Juro spider?
I doubt that. There's been another recent article published looking at the phylogenetics of the entire group of what we know as
the Nephilidae.
Okay, yeah. Nephila. And there's some thought that the old world spiders, if you will, in China, and there's a lot of species, may be not as closely related to the species in the New World, okay? And so the generic name, Nephila, may change to something else for the banana spider.
Okay. Both of these spiders are part of what's known as the golden silk orb weaver?
Right.
Okay. Probably the number one question for many people listening is, are they dangerous?
No. They're not dangerous. They're not dangerous to humans.
Right, but they're dangerous.
But all spiders have got some sort of venom, okay, that can be used to immobilize prey.
Right. But okay. Not humans.
But not humans. Okay, so we don't see any. There have been some descriptions of the bite of the Juro spider. It might be like a bee sting. This was from some literature in Japan, and it quickly goes away. All right, so these are not black or brown widows or brown recluse spiders.
Meaning that, but they're very efficient. They're very efficient hunters, though, of their own prey. Meaning that if you walk into your pantry and you find a really quite large banana spider, I mean, you're downplaying it, but they're big. If you find one in there, don't scream and smash it. right?
Call the Museum of Natural History.
And they'll come and collect your banana spider?
We'll come and collect your banana spider. But, you know, you're not going to find them in a house, all right? So they're aerial predators. They've got to set a web that has some access to either an active area where other insects are foraging or can be exposed to a clear shot through the air. And so in Asia, you may see photographs of Juro spiders built with webs built on between lines strung on power poles.
Yeah, and okay? It's kind of exciting to watch him hunt. There's videos on the internet that you can take a look at if you have the stomach for it. Bud Freeman does. He's the director of Georgia Museum of Natural History, and he will take those banana and Juro spiders off your hands should you find them in your yard. Bud, thank you so much.
Thanks, Celeste.
Just ahead, we take a trip to the General Muir. That's an Atlanta restaurant renowned for its Jewish-Mexican fare. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. It is a great week if you love both food and football. The Georgia Bulldogs beat Kentucky over the weekend, stomped them 42-13. But UGA's domination on the field doesn't match up with players' academic performances. Tomorrow we'll talk about why student athletes rank dead last in graduation success at UGA. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you care if college football players don't cut the mustard academically? Does it matter if those players never graduate? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can find us on social media. It's at OST Talk, and be sure to join us for that conversation tomorrow. Behind many great recipes, you'll find stories of immigration. That's certainly the case for Patty Hinich's kitchen. Her grandparents immigrated from Poland to Mexico, and now Patty is a chef and cookbook author renowned for her Jewish-Mexican fare. GPB's Emily Curitan caught up with her last week while she was cooking at the General Muir restaurant in Atlanta.
Hoy vamos a comer un menú muy interesante que refleja la gastronomía mexicana judía y vamos a comer gefilte fish a la veracruzana, una sopa de bolas de matza con...
It's food that I grew up eating in my Bobe's house. Every Friday we used to meet at my Bobe, which is my grandmother on my father's side, and she would have the gefilte fish Veracruz style. She would also have the traditional gefilte fish, and she would force you to choose one of the two, and then she would make you feel so guilty for choosing one and not the other. And she would have matzo ball soup, and she'd have brisket and cimes, and she'd make babka with Mexican chocolate and Mexican cinnamon. My name is Patty Hinich. I'm chef, cookbook author, and host of PBS Patty's Mexican Table. I'm cooking a Mexican Jewish dinner with Chef Todd Ginsberg, which I'm very excited about.
Okay, my name is Todd Ginsberg. I'm the chef owner of the General Muir, and right now I am finishing Patty's recipe for her balancillo and pasilla brisket, which I am just browning the meat now and about to go back into the sauce and sit in the sauce actually for the first time for service. So it'll be about 3 or 4 hours kind of slowly cooking a little bit more and taking a lot of those flavors on.
So I'm adding brown sugar.
Some of the holidays were supposed to remember the bitter times and then the sweet times. And then, so here we're adding some spice.
And actually, that's how we came up with the name of our restaurant, the General Muir.
Oh, really?
The General Muir was named after a U.S. refugee ship that my partner's mom and her grandparents came over from Holocaust Germany. They were Holocaust survivors. Her mom was born in a displacement persons camp, and the refugee ship was called the General Muir. So it's sort of about remembering the past, but also looking towards the future.
That's such a nice balance, because you want to preserve and pass on things that we should cherish and have inherited and are a wealth of knowledge, but we should also leave a door open to possibilities, like this meat. Here, let's taste. It's just incredibly rich. It's, you know, you take a little bite and it leaves such a big, beautiful echo in your mouth because it's a little bit sweet and it's briny and it's savory and it has the chunks of tomato and it's just really satisfying.
Patty Hinich is a chef, cookbook author, and host of the PBS series Patty's Mexican Table. You can find pictures and videos of the meal you just heard being prepared at gpbnews.org. The food on tables in most American homes does not resemble the food served in the 1600s colonial America. That's when the event we think of as the first Thanksgiving occurred. And that feast lasted for 3 days. A couple of years ago, we talked about what the first Thanksgiving meal might have tasted like with Lisa Abraham. She's the former food editor for the Columbus Dispatch in Ohio.
Historians have a big debate over where the site of the actual first Thanksgiving was. It depends on how you define Thanksgiving. If you think of Thanksgiving as the feast, then clearly Plymouth Rock has the win on that one. If you think of Thanksgiving as just sort of the colonists getting together and actually giving thanks to God for their safety and security in the New World, then probably Berkeley Plantation in Virginia gets the win on that one.
Okay, well then let's go with the traditional one, right, which was that 3-day feast.
Sure.
With the pilgrims and the Native Americans. And I understand there was wild turkey on the menu, right?
There's really no way to know. What we do know are the records. Historical records indicate that the governor of Plymouth Plantation sent a group of men out to go fowling, so hunting bird. There was lots of wild turkey in the area at the time. More than likely, they brought back duck and goose because it was so plentiful and so easy to go hunting for. They could have brought back a wild turkey. It's not in the record. The records just indicate they had fowls. So we can assume there was turkey or assume not. It's really one of those historical guessing games.
So, I'm reading an excerpt from the letter that you're probably referencing, and he says wild fowl was there, corn in grain form for bread or for porridge was there, venison was there. So let's
right.
take those one at a time, because listen, 3 days of feasting, that is a whole lot of food. So you say they had wildfire. How would they have prepared that? Was it just thrown in the oven and baked it?
No, they wouldn't have had ovens per se, but most likely it was roasted on a spit, so an open fire with a spit, and they would, you know, sit there like if you do chicken on a spit ever
right.
at a party.
Turkey's roasting on an open fire.
Exactly. Turkey's
right.
roasting on an open fire, or goose or duck roasting on an open fire. So most likely it was spit roasted. Now, as far as the venison, I mean, the records do indicate that the chief of Massasoit, who was chief of the Indian tribe, presented the pilgrims with 5 deer, which at the time was a huge honor because if you think about the fact that these pilgrims came from England, they didn't have access to deer because that would have been part of the estates, so the deer would have been hunted by the wealthy. So the pilgrims would not have had access to that kind of venison. So for them to come over and him to present them with 5 deer, I mean, that would have been a huge, huge honor because they were basically feasting on what the royalty in England were feasting on. So it was very clear they had venison. Again, they probably did some roasting over an open spit. They may have had some type of clay ovens or dirt ovens where they, you know, put some coals in the ground and covered it up to actually roast it. But they certainly wouldn't have had the ovens and cooktops that we think of today to do our feast on.
I want to ask you about one particular technique that I read that comes from a living history museum in Massachusetts. And they said that a lot of the birds were boiled first and then roasted. Or things are roasted first and then boiled. The early roasting gives them nicer flavor, sort of caramelizes them on the outside and makes the broth darker.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? Like you boil a turkey first?
Well, you know, in that time, one of the reasons they would have boiled it would have been to help get all the feathers and things off. You know, if you give it a nice boil, then all that kind of pulls off. So, you know, it was much more primitive than
yeah.
our cooking now. So, yes, they certainly could have boiled it, and that would have helped to sort of clean the skin off. And then they would have taken that skin and put it on the spit, you know, that bird and put it on the spit to get the nice and roasted.
Oh.
So the meat would have been kind of boiled and then sort of finished off on the spit.
Okay, I don't want to spend the whole time talking about meat. Let's move on to the side dishes, right? So what
okay.
is corn in grain form for bread or porridge?
You know, think about polenta, think about cornmeal. That's what we're talking about. So They would have turned it into a porridge. When we think of things like cornmeal mush, or if you think of things like, you know, polenta, that's what they're talking about. So really, like, corn turned into a porridge. Grits. You're in the South, so grits, obviously.
Yeah.
It would have been that type of a dish. And as you all know, if you have grits or polenta or cornmeal mush, if you let it sit for a while, it tends to congeal.
Yes.
And it becomes sort of a hardened form. And then you can take it and you can fry it. And so that would have sort of been their bread. You know, that would have been their starch.
Let me be clear here, because I want to make sure I'm really imagining the right taste. We're talking about some pretty bland flavors, right? I mean, they weren't throwing spices in there.
They were not. So we are talking about some very bland flavors. But, you know, if you think of the English diet at the time, anytime you would have been feasting or celebrating, it really would have been all about the meat, because meat was not something they could get all the time. You know, they're used to eating porridge. So I think the focus of the meal would have been on the fowl, and it would have been on the venison, of course.
Yeah.
It really would have been. I mean, there's an old saying that, you know, when the British wanted to celebrate, it was all about beef, bread, and barley, and meaning their beer. And unfortunately, there was no beer, because the Pilgrims had no barley crop that first year in Massachusetts. So
what they
drink? They had brought some beer and wine over with them on the Mayflower, but most of their stores were gone by then. In fact, there are records to indicate that that's what they were kind of grousing about, where, you know, we have no more beer, which was, you know, the British not to be able to raise a pint was a true tragedy. So
I think people would
most
still
likely
grouse
they
about
were
that
drinking,
today, Lisa.
Yeah, exactly. They were probably, you know, drinking a lot of spring water, obviously, and, you know, whatever... I don't know, kind of juices they may have been able to come up with from, you know, the native plants and that sort of thing. But most likely it was probably water. There were wild grapes, but certainly not necessarily the kind that you would have turned into wine. So there's no cultivated wine grapes at the time. So they wouldn't have necessarily had any wine, and all indications were their wine was running out. But they could have, I imagine, saved the last few bottles, the last few swigs for their Thanksgiving celebration.
I don't think it would last for 3 days, though. Let's talk about the other sides. Did they eat vegetables?
There were. I mean, they had actually, one of the reasons they were giving thanks is because they had such a plentiful harvest. So they would have had very classic English gardens. So a lot of greens, things like kale, which is so popular now, spinach, cabbage, a lot of those greens. They would
greens.
Have had, yeah, a lot of leafy greens. They would have had
How
a lot
did they
of
eat
fruit.
Them, though, Lisa? They didn't make a salad.
You know, they probably boiled them. As a lot of people do now.
Yay, more bland food.
More bland food. You know, they just didn't have the spices that they would have had access to in England, because the trade routes weren't established yet, so they weren't getting that kind of spice. So they had pumpkin, but certainly no cinnamon to go with it.
Or nutmeg.
They may have had some maple syrup, though, because obviously in the Northeast there's lots of maple sugar mapling. Going on. So there could have been some maple syrup.
So let me get this straight, Lisa. I just want to be clear that I'm imagining the right thing. Okay, we have roasted meats of various kinds, mostly birds, smashed corn, boiled spinach, and spring water. Right? This is
the feast? Yeah, you pretty much summed it up. There may have also been some mussels, because obviously Massachusetts, there were a lot of mussels there. There were no oysters, because the oysters were not in Plymouth Bay. They were about 50 miles south, which back then was a huge trip. So they didn't have oysters for their feast. They did have mussels, though.
What about, throw me a bone here. Was there butter, at least?
No. No cows.
For the love of Pete.
I know they had no butter, because there were no cows yet. Cattle didn't arrive for like another 3-4 years, 1625. And there was no bread that we would think of as bread, so probably no stuffing.
Potatoes? Mashed potatoes?
No potatoes. Potatoes didn't come to the New World from South America yet, so no potatoes, no sweet potatoes. Dried beans. They likely would have had dried beans that would have been rehydrated. So maybe some baked beans.
That's Lisa Abraham, former food editor for the Columbus Dispatch in Ohio. Store-bought turkeys are flying off the shelves this week, but as we just heard, Thanksgiving started with wild game. And for some Georgia families, catching your own food is still a holiday tradition. GPB's Emily Cureton recently joined one father and son duo as they hunted for deer in the woods of Middle Georgia.
My name is Evan Mixon. I'm 16 years old. I live in Macon, Georgia, and we're here at the land that we hunt at and trying to kill a deer.
Van Mixon, I'm Evan's father, live in Macon, Georgia.
I'm loading the gun. This is a 243 Winchester, and this is a hunting load. It's called a ballistic tip, and it expands when it hits something, so more devastating impact. This is his gun. It's a 308 Browning. Bolt action.
Be, you know, very quiet right now, maybe. Trying to go out of your way not to step on things that are going to make more noise. I'm going to go up first, and then I'm going to set the gun down because it's got a nice little prop up there, and then you can climb up. Okay. I'm ready when you are. I'm texting Evan. He's sitting about, I'd call that 25 feet away in the tripod stand. He's about the same level we are off the ground, which I'd say 15 to 18 feet. We're separated by a few small trees. But we can, you know, see parts of him. He can see parts of us. I'm just going to send him a text asking if he can hear us whispering. Oh, there's an owl. Oh, that's a nice one. He shot his first deer. We were in this stand together 2 years ago, and it walked out from that opening you see down there between the kudzu, and we watched it till it got right up in here, and I was talking to him just like this, you know, saying, you know where to aim, make sure you're steady, you know, don't jerk the trigger. And he did everything right. It fell right where he shot it there. And he actually shot it with the rifle that I shot my first deer with. You could say there's a supermarket right down the road. You don't have to do this. I'm like, what? I could, I could counter with it. I'm taking this animal a lot more humanely than this. The caged animals are treated and slaughtered, and I'm not wasting it, you know. I can't give you a definitive right, wrong. I don't know that there is one, but I don't feel bad. No. Deer over here. There's a small deer over here behind my right shoulder. Keep looking, you'll see it. Going behind us. It's walking directly behind us. It'll be off your left shoulder. It's a tiny. I would never shoot that deer. Afraid it just knew something was up. It looked right at me. You wouldn't think they could make their way through that kudzu, but I've seen they walk through there so effortlessly. I guess they have their lines, and it just looks like slicing through water. We're past legal hunting light right now, so yeah, I think, I don't know if Evan's on his way down or not yet. He may be waiting to see us move.
So is it disappointing when you sit with him or something?
No, I mean, it happens. It's hunting, it's not shooting.
That was 16-year-old Evan Mixon of Macon, Georgia, and his father, Van Mixon. This year marks Evan's first season as a licensed Georgia hunter, and that story was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear what's happening around your table this week. What are your holiday traditions, if you have them? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.